Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Want to get a chiseled look in the jawline? Sculpt and shape your jawline with added volume from Juvederm Volux XC. Juvederm Volux XC is an injectable gel specifically designed to be robust enough to improve moderate to severe loss of jawline definition. And it is the first and only hyaluronic acid filler approved for the jawline. Add volume to your jawline for a chiseled look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you. Visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com.
Whether the foot soldiers regard themselves as fighting in a, you know, quote unquote global jihad, I don't know. I don't think so.
We tend to focus our attention on events that occupy the news headlines. Often this means that parts of the world that deserve our attention as Muslims are neglected, or we spend little time to try to understand their significance. And who can blame us? The Muslim world is engulfed in conflict and famine, and led by authoritarian regimes that care little for the welfare of its people. We at the Thinking Muslims set ourselves three goals. Firstly, the need to raise issues that do not ordinarily occupy our minds. Secondly, I started this project after concluding that there are important thinkers in our Ummah from whom I want to hear more of. And lastly, there is a need to understand matters beyond our social media soundbites. Today, I feel we achieve all of these aims. The Sahel, a region spanning the countries in West Africa, has been rocked by instability for the past few years. There is what the West calls an Islamist insurgency that has provoked international intervention from France, the former colonial power, but also the United States. There's speculation that Russia and China are also interested in the region. The region is one of the richest in the world in terms of natural resources, including oil, gold and uranium. Yet it's one of the poorest in the world. The proceeds of these extractive industries really reaches the people. This week we talked to Dr. Alex Thurston, a specialist in the region and assistant professor of political science at the University of Cincinnati, to explain why the Sahel is important. Alex has written extensively about the region and is regarded as an authority on the subject. Dr. Alex Thurston, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, and welcome to The Thinking Muslim.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks a lot for having me. Really glad to be here.
Great. And really, Dr. Thurston, it's a pleasure to have you here. And I've really been looking forward to this discussion, partly because what is going on in the Sahel is very much a political blind spot for me. So please excuse me today if some of my questions are pretty much first principle questions, but I feel this is an area I would like to know more about, and I'm sure my listeners would like to explore further. So let's start with the basics of the Sahel, the geography. So when we talk about the Sahel region, we're really referring to countries in West Africa, that have been rocked by an insurgency the West calls an Islamist insurgency, namely Mali, Burkina Faso, Mauritania, Chad, and Niger. Can you tell me more about this region, its history and its people?
You know, as you know, the word Sahel comes from the Arabic Sahel, which means coast. And this is a metaphor, right, where the desert is being described as an ocean, and this region, this, you know, transitional region ecologically is being described as the coast of that desert or the shore of that desert. And so this is a region that is kind of in between the desert and the more agriculturally productive zones to the south. And a lot of the people there historically have made their livelihood through various forms of pastoralism or agro-pastoralism. It's a very ethnically diverse region. If you wanted to, you could apply the label Sahel to everything from, you know, Senegal and Mauritania in the west on over to Somalia in the east. But now it's most often used in the sense that you mentioned, right, to refer to these five countries. And those countries, and then particularly Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger, have been deeply, deeply affected in recent years by violence along ethnic lines, along ideological lines, violence by the security forces against civilians, including really, really, you know, gruesome forms of collective punishment. And then at the same time, there's been serious political instability, especially in Mali. You know, multiple coups, including a coup in August of 2020 and another coup in May of 2021. And so, you know, there's just extremely complicated interactions between the politics and the violence. And then all of this is playing out among, you know, countries that are literally, you know, most of them at the very bottom of the Human Development Index. I mean, these are literally the poorest countries in the world, with the partial exception of Mauritania, which is a little bit, you know, has a little bit more, you know, economic development and is also just more sparsely populated, you know, with a much lower population than the others.
You recently wrote a book selected as the winner of the American Political Science Association Politics and Religion section. The book is on jihadists in North Africa and the Sahel. And in the book, you discuss the nuances of these opposition insurgent movements. Can you tell us about these movements and who they are and what, if any, connections they have to, I suppose, what we may lazily call the greater jihadist movements of Al-Qaeda and ISIS?
Yeah, so this is, you know, this is a huge question. I mean, they, you know, the genealogy of these movements is often traced back to Algeria in the 1990s. So you have the Algerian Civil War, you know, breaking out in the early 90s. You know, gaining a lot of steam with the Algerian military's intervention against to abort the elections there in early 1992, and you had a sequence of, you know, armed groups in Algeria, the GIA, the Armed Islamic Group, the GSPC, the Salafi Group for Preaching and Combat, and then the GSPC rebranded itself as an affiliate of Al Qaeda in 2007, and then, you know, over time there. Actually, space to operate within Algeria shrank. So the Algerian government offered amnesties to some of the armed groups in the late 90s. There were massacres of civilians in particularly in 1997 that really horrified the Algerian population and that were blamed on the armed groups. And so they found, you know, the GSPC slash what became AQIM, Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb, found more and more opportunity in northern Mali and in the broader, you know, Sahara Sahel region. And so starting from, you know, even from the 1990s, but particularly from the 2000s, they became involved in various ways in, you know, business in the region, in cultivating political ties to local power brokers, and especially in kidnapping Westerners. So, and the, you know, particularly between about 2008 and 2012, 2013, they you know, raised a tremendous amount of money. You know, the estimates have run even as high as, you know, $90 million or more when you put all the ransoms together. You know, ransoms paid mostly by European governments, it seems. So then the AQIM, this affiliate of Al-Qaeda, became a major player, you know, maybe a secondary player, but still a major player in the Malian rebellion of 2012. And this gave them kind of a new level of presence and you know, recruitment potential and political impact in the region. Since then, they and particularly their kind of subsidiary called JNIM, Jama'at Nusrat al-Islam wal-Muslimin, or the Group for Supporting Islam and Muslims, you know, is a major player, is headed by Malian nationals. So there's been, you know, maybe you could say a Sahelization or even a Malianization of this movement. And some of the key Algerian commanders who were prominent a decade ago or 20 years ago or 25 years ago, have a lot of them have been killed at this point, you know, by French authorities or, you know, by the French military or others. So, you know, and then there's been, you know, all sorts of fragmentation, breakaway groups, you know, divorces, reconciliations, etc., between different hardline groups. One of them has then ended up becoming an affiliate of the Islamic State, so-called, right? So, you know, and they call themselves, or they're usually referred to as the Islamic State in the Greater Sahara, or ISGS. So these are the main two groups at this point, then the JNIM, the Al-Qaeda affiliate, and ISGS, the, you know, the affiliate of Daesh, or whatever one wants to call them. Their level of connection to the sort of global hierarchy, though, is a real point of debate. I mean, definitely formally, they belong to those global movements. In terms of their decision making and what drives them, I see them as primarily local movements, right? I think that they, you know, again, JNIM is headed by Malian nationals. The head of JNIM is somebody named Yara Ghali, a Tuareg power broker and longtime politician who came to the, you know, the jihadist milieu pretty late in life. Somebody, you know, who's often accounted a very, you know, shrewd political thinker. And so there's big questions about what he wants and where he's steering things. And you know, there's obviously some ideological overlap between him and somebody like Ayman al-Zawahiri, but on the other hand, you know, is al-Zawahiri, you know, calling him every day to tell him what to do? I really don't think so. You know, I think that there's a lot of autonomy. ISGS then, you know, is sometimes described as just sort of glorified bandits. And they also both, you know, both groups recruit very, very heavily at the local level. And some of the foot soldiers appear to be interested. And this is very hard to get at, right? Because it's you know, I've never directly talked with foot soldiers or anything. I mean, it's really difficult to get access to their perspectives. But it seems, you know, from what journalists say, from what emerges through other sources, that a lot of the fighters are interested in self-protection in a very dangerous environment. There are ethnic dimensions to the violence. There are opportunities for, you know, revenge against the security forces or against other communities. So it's very complicated what motivates people and whether the foot soldiers regard themselves as fighting in a, you know, quote unquote global jihad. I don't know. I don't think so. You know, not all of them.
That's interesting. So it's a very complicated landscape. So within that very messy picture, you argue that the portrayal often in Western media, the portrayal of these jihadist groups that operate in the Sahel is one of a nihilistic, one-dimensional set of actors. You know, they don't really have very clear political aims. Now, I think you argue that we should regard them as serious political actors. Tell me a bit more about what their aims are, what their political aims are, and what they hope to achieve from this insurgency.
Yeah, so I think, you know, they have debated this intensively among themselves, and I think there's been a couple of different models that they've pursued, and you know, and they've often been skilled at adapting to the changing circumstances around them, and the questions that they've dealt with are questions that other peer groups have dealt with in other parts of the world. So, for example, you know, some of them feel that the goal is to overtly take and hold territory and to create, you know, their version of you know, an Islamic emirate, so-called. That, of course, the problem with that, even from their perspective, is that it immediately invites the intervention of stronger military forces, you know, Western-backed or just outright, you know, Western military forces intervening against them. So this is, you know, a strategy that they have turned away from a bit. Some of the commanders have argued that, you know, basically you need a sequence of spectacular attacks, you know, high profile terrorist attacks and so forth to kind of shock local governments and throw them off balance. That, though, also seems to run out of momentum for them. It's hard for them actually, you know, there's a lot of low level violence, but they don't, you know, commit kind of spectacular bombings and so forth, maybe as often as one would expect. So what they seem to have settled into is a kind of a groove where they hold political sway without completely, you know, planting a flag and declaring themselves to be the explicit rulers of a place. And there's, you know, there's all sorts of theories in political science about this and so forth. Some, you know, some political scientists just see rebel groups broadly as greedy, self-interested actors who are in a kind of a money-making business. I think that's too simplistic to describe what's going on. I mean, I think there's a mix of motivations. I think that there are opportunities to make money amid the conflict, and I think that there are some, you know, serious conflict entrepreneurs out there. But I think also it's sort of an ongoing political experiment. And I mean, one thing that they do, and I think this is what actually really rattles, you know, some. You know, the national governments and some European governments is that they sometimes kind of outcompete the existing states, you know, particularly in terms of security provision and justice provision. It seems that local populations do not necessarily welcome them with open arms, that local populations are often, you know, very intimidated by them. On the other hand, the existing alternatives are sometimes either weak or absent, and that sometimes there's a preference on the part of the local population for these, you know, jihadist groups simply because they can be the best of the actually existing alternatives. There was a good piece in the New Yorker a while back by Anand Gopal about rural women in Afghanistan. He talked to women in Afghanistan. He said when he asked them about the Taliban, you know, and I think there's a big difference actually between the Taliban and these groups in the Sahel. But leaving that aside for a second, so when this journalist Gopal asked you know, women in rural Afghanistan about the Taliban, he said they didn't want to compare the Taliban to some sort of ideal. They wanted to compare the Taliban to the actual alternatives, you know, basically warlords or the predatory state or something like that. And that people preferred the Taliban in relative terms. And I think there's a bit of that going on. Now, at the same time, I don't think the jihadists in Mali and the Sahel actually really know where to go next. And I think that goes back to the experimental nature of it, because they can't, I really think at this point, they can't sort of plant the flag again and say, this is our territory, this is our state. That doesn't work. But I think they're not going to give up. One question then is whether any sort of dialogue is possible with them. JNIM, the sort of, you know, Al-Qaeda affiliated group and the Malian government have notionally, you know, expressed a theoretical willingness to talk to one another. But whether that could really go forward and what the content of such a dialogue would be, that all remains, you know, very, very unclear.
You argued initially that these groups have a level of political sophistication and one can't just regard them as, I don't know, nihilistic groups that use terror for its sake. But the jihadist movement since 9/11 must have realized that the tactics they employ invite a greater reaction, not only from local forces, but from international forces. And so the enterprise is doomed to failure. So it seems to me that the groups in the Sahel are repeating the same mistakes that groups in the Middle East have, apart from Taliban, and that's maybe a different example, as you said. But most jihadist groups in the Middle East have failed in that strategy to free the region of international and what they call secular forces.
Yeah, and so I think they get to a point, you know, and I do think it's pretty similar to other groups elsewhere in the world. They get to a point where they face a decision of either you know, isolating themselves politically and sticking with their original vision, or watering themselves down. And, you know, a lot of people, I don't follow Syria closely, but I think that, you know, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, you know, the HTS in northwestern Syria is almost the key experimental case for this, right? How far are they going to go in watering themselves down? They've been accused of you know, even by Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi and others, of diluting the project, right, to the point where it's no longer even jihadism anymore. And there's, you know, the debate isn't quite that far advanced in Mali, but there's a similar issue with this group JNIM. You know, how far would they go in terms of making compromises? And maybe they will. I mean, you know, because there's, I mean, this is, you know, in a way, I mean, they can throw a region into chaos, right? They can, you know, once they show up in an area, and this has been the pattern, especially since 2015 in Mali and Burkina Faso and Niger, you know, once they show up in a place, the military comes in, and these are weak militaries with, you know, very limited control and very limited ability to project force. So the military comes in and responds to them by rounding up the young men, you know, detaining them arbitrarily, torturing some of them, maybe just summarily executing some of them. This then, you know, really, really obviously, you know, upsets the local population, who refuse then to cooperate with the military. They're being intimidated by the jihadists. The jihadists then, you know, if they're recruiting heavily from a particular ethnic group, then that ethnic identity, some, you know, becomes politicized in a new way. Other ethnic groups start to target members of ethnic group A, you know, out of suspicion and collective punishment, even if those people are innocent. And then the whole situation, you know, just gets worse and worse. So, you know, and now there's a lot of concern about the insecurity spreading into Cote d'Ivoire, into, you know, Benin, into Togo, even Ghana. So there's no question that they can disrupt the environment around them. But then whether they can leverage that power into something meaningful, it still seems like a political dead end ultimately. But then the question is, you know, are any of the leaders interested in modifying their program such that they could have a seat at a negotiating table with the national government? So far in the Sahel, not really. They negotiate over things like hostage exchanges, over, you know, sometimes maybe very limited ceasefires. There's a lot of local level deals now where there's de facto divisions of territory. Despite the chaos they can cause, it doesn't seem, again, that they can really leverage that chaos for lasting political power.
Am I correct in saying that you are making a wider point about what we call security studies at Western universities and think tanks, and how they refuse to countenance that there may be legible political objectives sought by these groups? In your book, you make reference, I think, to, in fact, I've got the quote here, that Western policymakers and analysts often talk about radicalization and extremism as forces more akin to mass psychosis or individual deviance than as political processes. Individual fighters are seen as fanatics to be killed, or as patients to be cured, rather than as socially embedded political actors. What do you mean by this?
Yeah, I mean, so I think that, you know, it's interesting to look at the metaphors that you know, even liberal, right, even center left, you know, politicians will use in the United States or elsewhere, you know, talking about places as quote unquote breeding grounds for terrorists, or, you know, talking about contagion or movements metastasizing. I mean, often it's these, you know, epidemiological metaphors or medical metaphors, right, where this is depicted as, and it's very dehumanizing too. I mean, I have, obviously, you know, a lot of these groups have committed tremendous atrocities of their own, but I still don't think they should be dehumanized and just referred to. I mean, effectively, they're being referred to as mosquitoes, right, or as, like, you know, carcinogenic, you know, cancerous cells or something. I mean, so I think then from those, and I think those metaphors are deliberate, because I think it's either regarded as, you know, like I was saying in that quote, you know, they're regarded as fanatics to be killed, or as some kind of disease to be treated. And so the solutions become depoliticized, right? It's, you know, either the solution is purely military, kill them all, or it's kind of seen as a technical problem. You know, let's get our development experts in there who can come up with the right CVE programming or the right combination of development and CVE measures to kind of talk local populations off the ledge or something. I do think that, I think a lot of security studies work would say, okay, there's an ideology, but I think, there is a reluctance to treat them as political actors who may be expressing some kind of, non-psychotic demand on the part of the population.
You've been to the region. You engaged in field work across the Sahel, I understand. Did you meet with these groups, with its leaders, with its rank and file? And what was your, how did they respond to you? And what was your engagement? What level of engagement did you have with these actors?
Yeah, so I haven't sought out, direct contact with active members of armed groups. There are people who do that, and I think it obviously it can be a fruitful, line of inquiry. To me, though, I tried to talk with people who were, who had direct knowledge of the groups. And the closest that I came, and this, I think this shaped my thinking a lot, because in 2012, in Mali, 2012, 2013, there was a group called Ansar al-Din, right? So the defenders of the religion or defenders of the faith, something like this. And it included, right, Yara Ghali, who's the current leader of JNIM. It was very close to AQIM, to the affiliate of Al-Qaeda. But at the same time, it included a number of senior politicians, senior Northern Malian politicians, including some parliamentary deputies and so forth. And those people, because there was a jihadist takeover of Northern Mali in the second half of 2012. And then in early 2013, France intervened alongside the Chadian military and other militaries to dislodge them. So at that point in January 2013, when the French came in, this coalition, Ansar al-Din, broke apart. Some people went underground and went, the path of kind of full-time jihadism. And then some of them just went back into mainstream politics. And so it was that side of the actors that I was able to talk to. So some of the leading, northern politicians, including people who are very, very prominent today, and who are still sometimes accused, actually, of maintaining back channels with the jihadists. And so I think, that experience in part shaped my thinking, because, it made me think more about how some of these jihadist movements are coalitions. And I guess that's another, thing that makes me think about the politics of them, because there's a depiction, I think, and I think there's just been so much attention in security studies and in journalism to actually the European Muslims who have traveled to fight in Syria, right? Or in an earlier era, to people who traveled to fight in Afghanistan. And this has been portrayed as a process of individual level recruitment. And there's been a lot of attention to the supposed psychology or the life circumstances. And it's been portrayed, I think, in a very atomized way, that people come to ISIS or something like that as either individuals or as maybe very small friend groups. In the Sahel, and I think in other parts of the world, I think actually people come to groups in blocks. And that groups are put together, and it's not all sort of a homogenous process of recruiting people who are all thinking the same way ideologically. I think there's sometimes pretty explicit, deal making and so forth. And that under the banner of a jihadist movement, you can get multiple types of actors. You can get hardcore ideologically committed people. You can get a certain number of fair weather friends, right, who are going to go with a kind of a bandwagon effect and what they see as the stronger side at a given time. And you can get opportunists, and you can get people who are interested just in self-protection, and you can get people who are, you can get all sorts of circumstantial actors, right? So that's more the side then that I was able to talk to is some of the people who actually had been in a jihadist coalition and then left voluntarily.
So let's turn to the international counterinsurgency effort against these insurgency groups, largely led by France, which I think still has 5,000 troops on the ground with some support from the United States and other European countries. Can you tell me more about France's involvement and why it prioritizes this region in particular?
Yeah, so this goes back to your first question. I mean, something that I should have mentioned is that, overwhelmingly in West Africa, you're talking about former French colonies. With the exception of Nigeria, Ghana, Gambia, maybe a couple other places. And in the Sahel, these are universally French, former French colonies. And so there's been a lot of debate within France and within Africa about, you know, France-Afrique and the continued legacy of, you know, what some see as neocolonialism, what others just see as a high level of French influence. But I think there's no question that you know, France sees the Sahel as kind of its zone of influence. It sees itself as the preeminent, you know, foreign actor there. And I think that other Western countries defer to France on that. I mean, I think that the United States, for multiple reasons, you know, is very comfortable with having France, you know, quote unquote, in the lead, you know, and the US has seen itself more as a provider of intelligence and logistical support. France has sometimes, you know, depicted, one thing that I've said, you know, a couple of times in different venues now is that the Sahel is very different from Afghanistan, but that the way that the French talk about the Sahel is similar to the way that the Americans talk about Afghanistan, if that makes sense, that there's more similarity between the US and the French roles than there is in the underlying conflicts. And so, you know, sometimes the French have basically made this argument of like, oh, we're fighting them there so that we don't have to fight them here. And that doesn't really line up, actually, because the attacks that have been committed within France have not originated in the Sahel, you know, and have not even really, you know, from everything I've seen, originated in North Africa, even in a meaningful sense. And I think, too, then there's been a kind of, you know, self-perpetuating logic to the mission. And I think that the French have very much, you know, and they have complicated ways of talking about it. They have a whole, you know, coalition for the Sahel now, which has four pillars and all sorts of, you know, development components and so forth. But I think at the heart of their strategy is killing the people that they see as bad guys. I think, you know, they believe that, you know, raids against top targets, that those raids are going to solve the problem for them. And I think they often feel, okay, we're you know, just a couple raids away from really making a difference. And they've been remarkably successful in a narrow sense at killing top leaders. You know, they killed the head of ISGS, back in August of this year, I want to say. But it doesn't work, right? You know, they kill top leaders and then the violence gets worse. But I think that they've gotten kind of, they're trapped a bit in their own thinking and feeling that they can kill their way out of the problem.
I mean, is it just a connection with its colonial days and that France sees that in many ways this is still part of France's commitment? Or are there any economic interests that France have in the region that it needs to protect?
Yeah, I think that varies a lot from place to place, you know. So the French had seen for a long time northern Niger because of uranium production there as a key interest for them. In northern Mali, it depends on who you talk to. I mean, in Mali, there's a lot of suspicion, and across the Sahel now, there's a lot of anti-French sentiment, suspicion of the French role. Definitely people have argued to me that France is interested in controlling resources in northern Mali, you know, gold. Some northern Malians are confident that there's, you know, uranium there, even oil or something like that. I don't know. I'm not sold on any of that, because I think, you know, I don't think in northern Mali it's primarily about economic interests. I think that it's partly about power projection. I think that the French, you know, feel that they want amenable, maybe client states is too strong of a word, but I think that they want amenable governments, you know, across the region. I think that they see it, I don't know, maybe even in a possessive way as kind of their zone.
I mean, I remember a couple of years back, the French made a big deal out of the United States' so-called withdrawal from these counter-terror operations, Afghanistan being the most notable example. But even Donald Trump talked a lot about, his administration talked a lot about leaving the Sahel, and the French got very angry with this lack of contribution from the Americans. I think I remember the NATO is brain dead quote came out of Macron's mouth as a response to, it seemed, America's disinterest in fighting these Islamic counterinsurgencies. I just wonder, why is France apart from the reasons you've given, and maybe these are the reasons, but why is France so occupied with fighting what the Americans now call yesterday's wars?
No, these are good questions. And I think this is something I need to think about more. Cause I don't fully understand it myself. I mean, I think that they seem to be just at least conceptually trapped in a losing endeavor. I think that they have, you know, I think there's a domestic French component to this. I mean, I think there have not been, you know, tremendous French losses, you know, as part of Operation Barkhane. So they had the intervention in 2013, but then they replaced it with a Sahel-wide counterterrorism mission called Barkhane. The last time I looked, which was a couple months ago, but there had been something like 55 or 60 casualties. So this is not, you know, high casualties, but I think it's, you know, like the United States, like other Western publics, I mean, there's a lot of scrutiny now of casualties in these operations. There's a lot of debate in France, you know, parliamentary debates, you know, parliamentarians asking, what are we doing there, right? What is the point of all this? I think, you know, Macron, some of the others have talked about it in recent years he's been a little bit more ambivalent about it. I mean, sometimes sort of stubborn and saying, you know, we're gonna see this through, and then you know, and sometimes the French describe it in very sort of black and white moralistic terms, right? Almost we're there to fight evil in a black and white struggle. But yeah, sometimes even Macron has been kind of ambivalent about it in recent years. I don't know what'll happen after the next elections in France. I mean, maybe he would, if he wins, maybe he would even double down a bit, or maybe that would be an occasion for him to pull back. I really don't know. And I'm not sure that his own thinking is clear, actually, because he's been, you know, in different statements, he's been all over the place. I think before we started recording, you had mentioned about Wagner Group, right? And the Russian role. The United States now in Washington, there's a lot of talk about so-called great power competition, including in Africa, right? Fears of Russia and China. I think, you know, with the Malians, you know, the Malian government, maybe seriously or maybe more in a bluffing way, you know, flirting with Russia, the French may feel a little bit of competition there too, right? And feeling now that this traps them in a different sense, fearing that if they pulled back, there would be a vacuum for more Russian influence.
I mean, I would like to talk about the Wagner Group, but before I do, so Operation Barkhane, President Macron earlier this year announced that he would be drawing down on this operation and a good number of those 5,000 troops. He called for a withdrawal of those troops by early next year, I think it is. And they will be merged into a more of an international task force. I mean, tell me a bit about that. Is that France conceding that it can't do it alone anymore and it needs to work with others? Is it Macron responding to popular opinion in France, which is very much against this war? And election season is coming, and France doesn't need to be in this conflict. So overtly during that volatile period, what's going on here in terms of this announcement?
Yeah, I think, you know, and I'm not fully convinced that it is a withdrawal. Even, I mean, because of this task force that you mentioned, right? Sometimes looking at the numbers, it's felt to me like more of sort of, maybe it's too strong to call it a bookkeeping trick, but you know, sometimes they've talked about reducing the force levels of Barkhane while they increase the force levels of this task force Takuba, which is supposed to be, you know, as you say, drawing from multiple European countries, especially their special forces. With that, I mean, I think there could be, I think part of it may be, you know, France trying to, you know, acknowledging that they can't do it alone as much, but I think also it's trying to get more buy-in from other European countries, you know, to sort of bolster France's political position. But yeah, I think there's, you know, and I think that they're thinking hard now about multiple audiences, right? The French domestic audience, you know, where the polling, I mean, the last polling I saw a couple months ago, but opinion was pretty divided at this point. I mean, even 50-50. There's a ton of anti-French sentiment in the street, you know, in Mali and Burkina in particular, but a lot of the Sahelian elites, or some of the Sahelian elites, you know, particularly those in power seem to want French troops to stay. So it's a really tricky, I think, balancing act perception-wise for France. And I think, maybe this is too cynical on my part, but I think that the overall force levels and the overall strategy, again, of just trying to kill, you know, the bad guys as they see them, I think there's going to be more continuity than change.
And what about the Wagner Group then? I mean, it seems, again, that, as you said, that the conflict is inviting great power competition. And the Wagner Group, there's no secret, but the Wagner Group is really an extension of the Kremlin. And it's, you know, it's a unofficial arm of the Russian state. What interest does Russia have in the region, in particular in Mali? And I think the government has recently invited the Wagner Group to defend the capital and to fight this counterinsurgency against the so-called jihadist groups. What is the Russian interest here? Why is Russia getting involved?
Yeah, so there's been, you know, there's been a lot of analysis of this. I mean, Wagner Group present in Central African Republic, in Libya, you know, in other parts of the continent, you know, and has been accused of committing, you know, serious atrocities and abuses in those conflict theaters and beyond. In terms of Russian interests, I think, you know, there's a sense that Russia wants to project greater influence in Africa. There's been a number of, you know, new or renewed defense and military cooperation agreements between Russia and different African countries in recent years, you know, sales of Russian helicopters or other military equipment. Sometimes I've read that Russia does not have kind of a generic interest in Africa, but they have specific, you know, interests linked to mining and so forth. And that, you know, in that sense, actually Mali would not be at the top of their priority list. I think that, not that Russia is just like trolling or something, but I do think that they are thinking about how to mess with Western Europe sometimes, you know, and how to shake them up. I think that, you know, and Sergei Lavrov and you know, Malian officials had met in a very visible way, you know, at the sidelines of the UN General Assembly meeting in New York back in September. You know, that they've I think really, you know, and maybe some of this comes back to perceptions. I think that the Russians have been almost gleeful about, you know, showing off some of this potential for cooperation with Mali. And there's also, you know, there's some serious historical ties there too, going back to the Cold War. I mean, you know, Mali was relatively close to the Soviet Union. There's still a lot of Malians around of an older generation who studied in the Soviet Union, who speak Russian and so forth. So there are some meaningful historical ties. I think too, sometimes in the region now, Russia has a bit of popularity just because it's not France or not the United States, you know, and there's maybe a little bit of, kind of, yeah, just support for Russia as a way of sticking it to Paris or to Washington. Whether they'll go in or not, I don't know. You know, I mean, I've seen the analysis that, you know, this is almost a done deal, bringing in the, you know, the Wagner Group to do, you know, pretty serious operations and to protect the authorities. And I've also had the thought, and you know, and I've written this, that maybe this is kind of an extended bluff by the Malian authorities. I mean, they now are negotiating hard about the French presence, about the transition back to civilian rule after the latest coup, you know, and the military rulers of Mali basically seem interested in preserving their own power, at least over the medium term. So they, you know, potentially by threatening to bring in, you know, more Russian influence, they have a big negotiating chip with France to ease up on pressuring them to cede power back to civilians. So there's a lot of moving parts, I think.
That's really interesting. And actually it gets more complicated with the role of the United States. Now, the last administration, as I mentioned, as you mentioned, talked about drawing down and not committing effort and troops to the region. I mean, its commitment was quite slim anyway, but it seemed like Donald Trump and his administration had given up. And that's partly, I suspect, to do with the rise of China and the focus on the Asia Pacific. However, the new Biden administration has made a point of saying that America is back. And I think Antony Blinken, if I'm not mistaken, the Secretary of State, visited the region in the first week, at least the beginning stages of the Biden presidency, and talked a lot about re-engaging with Africa and with the Sahel region. I don't know. I haven't seen anything since from the administration, apart from at the G20, there was some discussion with France about committing more assets and effort to the Sahel. But how do you summarize the role of the United States at present in Africa in general, I suppose, but also in the Sahel region in particular?
Yeah, I think it's still sort of emergent. Blinken, he had done some meetings early on, and then he was actually a week or two ago, he did a mini Africa tour. I want to say he went to Kenya, Nigeria, and Senegal, so pretty close to the Sahel, but not directly there. And I'm sure that in Nigeria and Senegal, maybe Senegal in particular, the Sahel was very much at the center of his discussions. The trip seemed to be, thematically, it seemed to be focusing pretty generically on kind of economic partnerships and democracy. And the Biden administration has made a lot of, has talked a lot about democracy, although like basically every American administration, they've been accused of being huge hypocrites on that, which, many American administrations have been. I think that it's a bit of a transitional time because there's still a lot of concern, particularly about, ISIS affiliates in Africa. There was a designation earlier this year, I want to say, of ISIS affiliates in Mozambique and in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. This is something that the administration is thinking about a lot. But then there's also this kind of talk about the great power competition and the fear of China and Russia around the globe, but also in Africa. I think probably on a day-to-day level with Africa policy that I think East Africa looms larger for them right now. When I see statements from them, it's often about Ethiopia or about Sudan or places. Ethiopia, I think, is priority number one for them at the moment. So the Sahel, maybe even within Africa, a secondary priority. At the same time, there's permanent now infrastructures in the region. There's drone bases in Niger. There's a longstanding counterterrorism training program and so forth. So the U.S. is not as involved as France, but there are sort of cross administration programs that aren't going anywhere, I think.
And finally, I'd like to ask you about China. You talked about Senegal there, and I think in the week that Antony Blinken visited Senegal, the foreign minister said that she would like China to have a greater involvement in the counterinsurgency in the Sahel region. China, as we know, is the biggest trading partner with Africa, and it has material interest, economic interest in the Sahel region as well. What role do you see China playing? Do you feel that China can be enticed into providing more material support or engaging with this counterinsurgency, or is China's role more economic and it doesn't want to get its hands messy at this stage?
Yeah, my knowledge of China and Africa is unfortunately a bit superficial. I think that from what I know, I think that they are reluctant to get involved in things like that. So even when their own personnel are affected, there were, I want to say, three Chinese workers who were kidnapped in Western Mali earlier this year, and they were just released. It was a very murky incident, actually, where they escaped and the Malian military picked them up. Even in those cases, I don't think incidents like that so far, from what I can tell, are whetting any Chinese appetite for greater involvement in counterterrorism or anything like that. I think that they still see themselves as primarily, an economic trading partner. But yeah, there may be more pressure on them as time goes by. This has been what a lot of China-Africa analysts have been saying for a while, is that it's going to be hard for China to maintain a narrow economic relationship with Africa without getting drawn into different, political developments or security developments.
Dr. Fersen, it's really great to have you with us today. And I think that was a fascinating discussion. We explored all the various dimensions. And actually, one final question. We forget the human factor to this ongoing conflict in the region. The ordinary African, the ordinary Muslim, the ordinary citizen of the Sahel region. You know, I've heard about mass displacements and you know, now internal migration between countries. You know, can you paint a picture of what this insurgency and this counterinsurgency, with all the complications of the Russian, possible Russian involvement and the French counterinsurgency, what impact is this having on just the ordinary person living in this region?
Yeah, this is a great question, and a really, you know, a sad one. I mean, there's you know, it's a region with tremendous wealth on multiple levels, right? On a cultural level, you know, and there are a lot of resources in the region, but at the same time, you know, the baseline level of development and poverty and so forth was bad even before the current round of crises broke out. You know, this is a region, for example, that has serious susceptibility to famine and drought. You know, so even if there were no armed groups in the region, this would be a zone of serious precarity and suffering. And then, yeah, I mean, as in you know, other conflicts, there's the death toll on the battlefield, but actually it's the displacement and the humanitarian impact that's the most disruptive. I mean, in Burkina Faso, for example, the last time I saw, you know, something like 1.3 million people were displaced out of a population of roughly 20 million. I mean, this is you know, catastrophic levels of displacement. And then sometimes you get, you know, the humanitarians will talk about complex humanitarian emergencies. So you'll get displacement combined with, you know, medical emergencies. This is a region that's highly affected by malaria. You get cholera outbreaks. Refugees then, you know, and internally displaced persons can generate also, you know, or not generate, but they can encounter all sorts of tensions with host communities. There's long-term questions in the region about youth unemployment and just what the future of the future of the economies and the societies looks like. And there are some grim scenarios. I mean, things, in a sense, you would think, okay, this is rock bottom, but I think it could actually get worse. I mean, I'm sorry to be so grim, but it's just, yeah, it's the figures on the humanitarian side are really, really scary.
Dr. Alex Ferson, thank you for your time today.
Yeah, thank you very much. Really enjoyed the conversation, despite the grimness of the subject. Yeah.
The biggest names in tennis are coming to Paris for the most anticipated Roland Garros in years. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. Experience 3 weeks of unparalleled tournament access as the world's top players in tennis face off against each other. Will the veteran champions continue their dominance, or will a fresh face emerge to challenge their legacy on the clay courts? Daily live coverage of this epic showdown begins Monday, May 20th. Don't miss a matchup. Stream it now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.